You are listening to Radio Albion.
To another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today is the 7th of December, 2022, and despite that date, we won't be talking about Pearl Harbor because that's been done 100 times in the past, you know, from our point of view. Now, I have to apologize for the audio. My microphone is older. And it may have knocked itself off, but so I'm using the onboard microphone, my computer. I used to do this a long time ago. I have a new microphone coming in, so I apologize for that. The Bitcoin world, as you know, is in chaos. We know why. Always keep in mind that money doesn't disappear, it only changes hands. And because of that, I lost money in Bitcoin. And given that fact, it wouldn't be awful if I received, not just donations, but especially now that we're in the pre-Christmas season, my merchandising store and my books, depending on who you think you're going to give this to, maybe excellent Christmas presents, eccentric Christmas presents, but maybe good. Now, even beyond that, oh, and by the way, I have a kitten who wants to be my co-host, so she's going to be wandering around here. She's now on my notebook as we speak, and so I want to, again, apologize for all of this in advance, but she insists on working with me here. And if that's not bad enough, today we're going to talk about someone, Anicius Boethius. In my books on the Middle Ages, my books on realism and nominalism, I didn't mention him. And despite having a more or less substantial point of view on universals, I didn't mention him in either book. So I want to talk about him now, and I want to talk about him for a whole bunch of reasons. The main one being, given the fact that he died roughly in 524, he is one of the founders of medieval philosophy in the West. And not only that, was a theologian in his own right. He was canonized. He was canonized in 1883 by Pope Leo, but only in the Diocese of Pavia. I never quite understood that. There's a few others who are only saints in a specific geographic area, and I don't know. He's either a saint or he isn't. But I have the feeling that that has something to do with popular acclaim. And of course, by 1883, there was a formal means of canonizing people. So the compromise is having his veneration specifically in a small area, the area where he is at the time most famous. But Boethius also is extremely interesting for another reason, and that is his condition. In fact, the reason why he wrote his best-known and final work of philosophy. He was an advisor. He was, you know, he was well educated. He was from a very powerful family. While he was adopted, that didn't change anything. He was an advisor to the Ostrogothic king Theodoric. In fact, his chief advisor. And he was present at the conference between Odoacer and Theodoric in neutral ground near Italy. Now, it's important to understand the context here. I know some of my listeners know a fair bit about Rome, Western Rome, and the fall of the city. But we're at a period of time, the post-450 era, the crisis of that century, where Rome was going broke, Rome was under attack from many sides, and the leadership was at best very spotty. So much of the urban population was on the dole when it comes to their bread ration, and once the Vandals took North Africa, that became a huge problem. Their tax base was getting smaller and smaller, and the army was largely non-Romans. You have this this list of non-Roman but very talented generals, people like Aetius, and people like Runciman, died in 472, and Odoacer himself. This is at the time of after the murder of Emperor Majorian, who lost a huge amount of territory, but Ricimer was one of his was his main commander, and he did retake some territory. The pattern is you have very talented generals who then become very powerful, and either they create puppet kings or themselves are murdered. Once Majorian was killed, he became they simply installed puppets. Augustolius, I guess you can call it little Augustine, August took over. That's the era of Odoacer, and the throne was largely vacant. And this is, coming to the end of the 5th century, the medieval kingdoms that we know are coming into existence. In fact, Odoacer pledged allegiance to Zeno in the east. And eventually, Theodoric was used by the Eastern Empire to retake Italy, which was successful. And this brings us to yet another sack of Rome, and it lands us to this era. Boethius was orthodox in the sense that he had rejected the heresies in the West of the time. And at the treaty between Odoacer and Theodoric, he was present, and then afterwards, pretty much everyone. I mean, Theodoric was an unpleasant man. Was only a mercenary anyway. And he defended a few of Theodoric's enemies within his own command structure. And that got Boethius sent to prison. Theodoric murdered Odoacer and his entire family. So Boethius, after having for the time, a very privileged life, and was very trusted, very honest with everyone he knew, is now thrown in prison and sentenced to death without much of a trial, and having lost everything. And of course, as he's writing this, the book, of course, is a consolation of philosophy, and as he's writing this, he is, of course, in a miserable, wretched condition in his cell. And depression, anxiety, all these things take over. He turns to philosophy as if it's some sort of a way to console yourself, hence the title of the book. And it's no shock that when we get into situations like this, we feel a little bit better if we believe that this was meant to be, that no one's really at fault. This is just how things have been mapped out, and it's virtuous to accept your fate. But of course, this brings a whole lot of problems, and this brings us right into the midst of his work. How did he handle it? He dealt with freedom of the will relative to God's foreknowledge. And this had been done in the East before. Augustine dealt with this before, but Boethius became famous after his death on this issue. He was a Platonist. He was not a nominalist by any stretch of the imagination. He had strong Eastern connections and was, as far as Southern Europe was concerned, was a cosmopolitan man. The Consolation of Philosophy comes into existence at a time, and in his mind, most powerfully at a time where he loses everything. Now, what he has left is a separate issue. And he is ready to die, but not for any virtuous reason. He's sitting in a cell, he's miserable, and a woman appears to him. This is the embodiment of reason, the embodiment of everything that philosophy is supposed to be. She's carrying a scepter, she has a stack of books. The Greek Theta is on one part of her, Pi is on another part of her. And, of course, he explains that Theta refers to metaphysics and Pi refers to ethics. This is a almost, not logos by any means. It may be connected with the Eastern concept of Sophia, but it may be not that complicated. It ends up being simply the embodiment of wisdom that only seems to show up when people are in their lowest state. Boethius, now this is a work sort of like how Plato wrote Socrates as a character in these dialogues. He's kind of doing the same thing. And it should be noted that Boethius' career was not just political. He was the man who reintroduced Western Europe to Aristotle. It's commonly thought that there was only from the Islamic University of Toledo in Spain that Aristotle, from Arabic translations, was brought into Western Europe. Well, that certainly is true. But to think that Western Europe was ignorant of Aristotle is ridiculous. And one of the works that he cites here is On Interpretation. And it, to some extent, it has to be understood to get where he's going here. And he gives an example. And we're talking about free will. And Aristotle actually uses the sea battle analogy, which Boethius mentions, with the conception he's talking about predestination. If you say that there's going to be a sea battle tomorrow, there is only one of two answers possible. Either it will happen or it won't happen. And once it happens or does not happen, it is that way forever. It's true now for eternity. And then once it's true or false, it can never become anything else. It's a fact even today. And the conclusion here is that in terms of possibility, nothing is possible except for what has happened. God knows this, of course, in advance. So what does that have to do with freedom? And it's maddening to hear people today ask this question as if they've stumbled upon some profound understanding that, of course, is, well over 1,700 years old. They think that, oh my God, I'm not a Christian now because I've discovered that the freedom and predestination issue, so what difference does it make? Foreknowledge, it's said, implies predestination. The problem is, you come across people who say things like, God permits these horrible things to happen, and therefore, I deny him or reject him or whatever, which doesn't make any sense. This is not an excuse for atheism, but then it also comes from very simplistic reasoning. What they're saying is they want the world set up in such a way that nothing bad ever happens. It's one of the most common arguments you come across. And again, people think that they've just discovered this. Sorry about that. A very excited dog behind me. But of course, none of these, and the two propositions that I mentioned, neither one of them follow from each other. Anyway, what they're looking for is a world that's organized in such a way that nothing bad ever happens. That's essentially what they're implying when they say, how can God possibly let me lose my job or, you know, invent some terrible thing that they think happened? How can he permit that? Therefore, he's responsible. That has nothing to do with atheism one way or another. That has nothing to do with morality either, since God is the creator of everything. Therefore, if you don't want a purely determined universe where nothing bad ever happens, I can't imagine what life would be like there. I think people, what Dostoevsky has said, they would create trouble just to get out of the boredom. Freedom implies that evil is a possibility, almost an inevitability, depending on how strong people are. This is the human condition. This is why the struggle exists. So you either have freedom, which is the possibility of evil occurring, or a purely deterministic machine where everything is set out in advance and nothing bad ever happens. They try to pull at your heartstrings with this, you know, people are dying and, you know, this nonsense. But Boethius, his problem is that it does not follow that foreknowledge automatically means predestination. They're two different things. God knows that something is going to happen. Doesn't imply that he lays everything out in advance, and there is no freedom as this process continues. They are two different things. Foreknowledge, put it differently, foreknowledge of God, what's going to happen, does not imply that the world, therefore, is a machine where God knows everything. And the distinction is a very important one. This is one of the things that spurred continued theological. I mean, there's really nobody in the Middle Ages that Boethius has not influenced. And, you know, he comes to these conclusions. I mean, he had written and translated years earlier. But now he's facing this squarely. And he really has nothing to lose at this point. Knowing that something is going to happen does not imply that there's any control over the will. There are two different circumstances. There are two different forms of knowledge. But even if you're willing to accept that, even if you say, okay, that's true, but God knows how it's all going to end up, so why not just judge us now? That's, you know, the famous examples used a million times. And the answer is this. Things that are known are not known in and of themselves, not as such. They're known relative to the capacity and the circumstances of the person who knows. And this comes up constantly, even today, because these people act as if God is somehow subject to human limitations, that the creator of something then has no power over it. And our limitations make considering God's point of view almost impossible, and yet they very arrogantly believe they could think from his point of view. Or alternatively, they say, how come he can't think like me? We perceive things, we know things, we describe things only from the point of view of being human, with all of our sins and all of our problems and all of our stupidities and all of our errors. But the limits, these very limitations, place even more limits and parameters on what in fact could be known at all. The notion of time is one of the big problems here. It's the biggest error. We live, of course, in a movable time, a mechanism, so to speak. Things take time to pan out. Things occur in steps. We exist in this past, present, future, with the present being very, very hard to pin down, because the minute you pin it down, it's not the present anymore. However, and this is an additional error, people think that infinity and eternity are the same thing. Eternity implies just a perpetual, nonstop, 1 minute to the next, forever. Infinity, however, is atemporal. It isn't in time at all. Because really, as Aristotle would say, time implies imperfection. Perfect being, perfect circumstances, as God is, doesn't need time, he has no use for it. Only imperfect beings have any conception of time. Because in God's world, nothing changes. The difference for us, of course, is that God has deliberately entered time, primarily with Christ, but even before then, where Logos has is consistently being part of the temporal order. Now, Aristotle's definition of God, he's not a part of anything. Because he's self-contained, he does not move. Because motion, again, implies you have to do something, and a perfect being doesn't have to do anything. Oftentimes, people think of the infinity in which God lives and functions, and is, in fact, is the same thing as eternity. Eternity is a metaphor. God lives in what Augustine would call the eternal now, the eternal present. His solution, and you know this can get extremely complicated. I could watch someone walking. I could watch someone doing anything. And all of the things being equal, I know that for a fact. There's no question I'm seeing somebody walk. But that knowledge doesn't imply that his walking is in any way determined. Of course, he could stop. But even knowing that doesn't mean that he hasn't willed himself to do all of those things. You're talking about two different orders of existence. Infinity on the one hand, and our very odd grasp of time on the other. And that infinity and eternity are not the same thing. Now, this isn't necessarily to say that in heaven there is no time. I'm not going to speculate on that. It just is that God, Trinity, is not in time unless, of course, he explicitly limits himself, as Christ did, to enter time and space. Okay. So, this being, this Sophia, this woman, this image who's glowing and it's always changing in height and stuff like that, says to him that there is no reason for you to be miserable. Ultimately, what Boethius is doing, shifting gears for a second, we'll come back to this in a minute, is he's pining for his old life, because he was a very privileged man, very educated, very well respected. Now, of course, not only does he have none of this, but he isn't respected anymore, because people are stupid. And if you know an authority says that you are a traitor, well, pretty much people with a lot of other things to do believe that you are. It's an error. It's like the errors we've mentioned before. It's an error to respond to something like this with anger or anxiety or misery. We share, I mean, most people do, this delusion that what we possess by fortune somehow is ours. We could have just as easily been born without any of these things, adopted by this very powerful family. It's not really you necessarily, despite the work you may have done. You have to be in a position to do the work in the first place. This concept that when we are blessed with some kind of fortune, that somehow we deserve it, and it should last forever. But we realize, of course, we don't like to realize this, but that it is very unstable. The good things existed in his life primarily because he thought they were good. He believed that they were good. There's a social consensus that these things are good. But then philosophy says something else. It says, you know, I'm saying this. You know, David Hume, many centuries later, came up with the fallacy of misleading vividness. For some reason, it's always been my favorite informal fallacy. It's that we value or remember or put greater weight on things that were very powerful to us. Traumatic things, for example. Things that occurred today as opposed to 5 years ago. And it is a fallacy because you put so much weight on these things because either we remember them, or they were very powerful, or they suited us, or they were very painful. And that doesn't add or subtract value to them. But we tend to focus on these things, and that is an informal error of thinking. So philosophy ultimately says, that's one of the, I mean, she doesn't use these words, but it's very clear that this misleading vividness is what's bothering him. That the most powerful and famous aspects of his personality, being a diplomat and being a scholar, that was taken from him. But that doesn't mean they are of greater value than the other things that he actually still possesses. And this is common, as you see the same thing with Socrates. He still has reason. He obviously has a certain degree of freedom because he's able to write. He's able to speculate. He obviously isn't starving to death or anything like that. You didn't have formal prisons back then. He was kept in confinement somewhere. And then, ultimately, he's ahead. Because if you take an entire lifetime, again, this is why the vividness is such a problem. Don't just talk about the things that really bother you or that really strike you. The entire sum of your life, it doesn't matter what happens to Boethius at this point, he's still ahead of pretty much everybody else. How many people at the time can say that they were a diplomat at this very important peace conference that eventually destroyed Rome forever? Or that, you know, had his scholarly influence over what turns out to be an entire era of history? That he had his health, he had his reason. He had a lot of things, quite frankly, that most people will never see. But because the most powerful of them, the most vivid of them, have been taken away, he is wallowing in misery. But even his misery, even to the extent, even if it was legitimate, it's still going to pass. It's still going to disappear. The future isn't yours. Fortune, and this is, you know, they refer to fortune as if it's fate, gives and takes away. It's difficult to then really enjoy anything because you know, I don't know how much money you might have, one lawsuit, one stupid thing you do, one bad investment, and you're finished. So a billionaire can be reduced to a millionaire and be absolutely miserable because, oh my God, how many tens of millions have I lost? And people are looking at him saying, well, you're still a millionaire. You had to sell 5 houses, but you still have 3. But from their point of view, that's still a very far direction to fall. That's a far way to fall. So to the person involved, it's horrible and humiliating and degenerating. But for people around him, well, he still is, you know, doing okay. And even if he lost everything, so long as he still has his reason, so long as he still has his freedom, and you could still be free in a prison cell. The old Stoics made that argument many times. Socrates made that argument. And many people simply refuse to be free. Many people refuse to be reasonable. And they amount to nothing. So you line up their lives and who comes out ahead. So then, what is ours? And the answer in good Stoic form is virtue. Now, this is where Boethius, as a Platonist, really comes into its own. And virtue is a possession that no one can take away. It doesn't make any difference what your situation is. In fact, it shines more greatly, more powerfully, in times of misery than in times of what we consider to be well-being. We all know that what society considers success, or what it considers what happiness is based on, isn't true. There are just as many problems that develop from prosperity as from poverty. Just in prosperity, we could laugh and say, well, yeah, you're miserable in a Mercedes. Yeah, but you're still miserable. A poor person and a rich person may be in the same amount of debt, just the rich person's debt is much higher. The pressure is still the same. What a virtue is, to some extent coming from Aristotle, these are weapons at your disposal. Aristotle said these are tools that you have that, if used properly, lead to happiness. Now, of course, what's happiness? This is where getting out of the modern mentality, or even Boethius' mentality, is, and he's, you know, he's coming to realize this as he's writing. Ultimately, pain does more to help us develop than prosperity does. No one likes it when you're going through it, of course. But if you're sensitive and smart enough, you realize once it's over, you've changed. You've changed for the better. You've proven that you can come through the worst possible things and still remain strong. This is where virtue is manifest to everyone. It can't be taken away tomorrow, like other, you know, more simple forms of happiness can be. But these things, whether it be pain or pleasure, are equally delusions. They have more to do with how we interpret things than actually the things themselves. In fact, the old Stoic idea is that things themselves are all neutral. What matters is how we react to them, and what makes it more complicated is how society perceives it. You know, use the example of someone in the NFL who wins a Super Bowl and makes a huge amount of money, and everyone wants to be like him. And then you remember, wait a minute, this is just a game. This is just rules that people have agreed upon. It's not really productive of anything. And yet, look at the word, and who wouldn't want to be one of those guys, right? But someone like Boethius and the Stoics would say, no, there is nothing good about that. He's playing a game. Boy, if we played a game all day long, we'd be considered bums. But they're good enough to get enough people to watch them to get paid. There is nothing productive about that level of so-called success. He actually hasn't produced anything. And even the virtue that they may, the discipline that they may require, has nothing to do with social life. It's just playing this game and everything that entails. Remember, roughly at this time, a bit earlier, the gladiatorial games were banned because, you know, when Christianity was just becoming part of the social and political life of the empire, it didn't make a lot of sense that people were slashing each other open for the entertainment of idiots. That was not considered virtuous at the time, no matter how good of a fighter they are. If they're fighting for the empire, it's one thing. But just for sport, for people betting, there is no virtue there whatsoever. Pain is the great teacher. Even if it's just an interpretation on our side, it is still, or even if it's physical pain, something you can't avoid, it is a teacher. It brings us to the good more efficiently than pleasure does. Somebody who doesn't have any problems, somebody who was so spoiled, and I know a few people like this, but they're so spoiled, they've never really had to call out to God before. In fact, they've never had to worry about anything, except we would certainly consider to be a very trivial problem that, of course, I always exaggerate. This comes down to saying that all fortune is good fortune. It may punish us. It may discipline us. It may make us happy. It may make us sad. All luck, as Boethius would say, is one of two things. It's either useful or it's just. Plato, very famously, Gorgias, and a few other places. The Gorgias was the very first book of philosophy I ever read when I was 17. That it is far better for us to be punished for doing evil things than doing evil things and getting away with it. Because those who get away with it have no limitation on their desires. They get away with everything. They become spoiled rotten. They have no conception of limits. They can take advantage of people. But someone who's punished is forced, like Boethius is here, to reflect and to see where he went wrong. This is what the so-called penitentiary. A penitentiary has the word penitent in it. The infamous bread and water concept is a fast. Fasting releases oxygen from digestion to mental acuity. This is not an accident. Now, of course, today the prison system is ridiculous, but that was the point of it, that this experience can lead you to an entire new life you didn't even think you were capable of, all because you did something stupid but didn't get away with it. And Boethius says that this fear, when we live with this fear that we're going to lose things, that we're going to get sick, that people we love are going to get sick, fear is based on our own idiosyncratic or at least social intersubjective interpretation of things. That doesn't mean that we're correct. There's not a whole lot of socially redeeming qualities to being a fullback. That doesn't serve any use in society. At most, a diversion. And yet they're rewarded more than almost anyone else is. These are shadows. We give them meaning. They don't have this meaning in and of themselves. So, you have to get to the core of what he's talking about here. You can't talk about a system or a concept like this without getting to the heart of what the system is which supports it. Nothing exists just on its own. Boethius, of course, he is both an expert in both Plato and Aristotle. And Aristotle had, as many of you know, the doctrine of the four causes. Material, formal, efficient, and final. The material cause is what anything is made out of. You take any example. The formal cause is how it's designed, how it's structured. The efficient cause, it is specifically the proximate cause, how it comes about. You know, a table or is created by the discipline of carpentry and a specific carpenter. The final cause is what we're talking about here. The final cause is what it's for. God is the final cause of the universe because God is fully happy in the ancient sense of the term. To use Thomistic language, he is fully actualized. There's no potential in him. God is what everything desires. It's happiness without any strings. It's happiness without any limitations. You can't take God's happiness away or anyone who is closely associated with it. He keeps the fabric, this moral structure of the universe together, which dips into the formal cause. But the formal cause is subservient to the final cause. Another way to put all this is that the evil don't really prosper. I first came across this developed in St. John Chrysostom. St. Basil has a variation of it too. The evil don't really prosper. They would love for you to believe that they're happy and that they're prosperous. But as I mentioned before, whatever good they may get for themselves is not good at all. They get away with things. They always get too greedy. They always end up getting caught. And even if they don't, they have to live with a certain fear that tomorrow everything can come falling down. Only the good can be happy. But, as Boethius, so many others at the time said, happiness is identical to the good. The good is God himself. The form of the good used for Platonic language. In fact, he goes so far as to say that the evil doesn't exist in its own right. It's the misuse of something. It's the privation of something. Things that God has created are all good. That doesn't mean that human beings can't use some of this stuff for ends that it was never meant for. So that means if the evil are misusing reason, I mean, you could be a brilliant criminal. That is neither good nor productive of happiness. Now, we're not talking about the mentally ill. We're not talking about sociopaths. We're talking about normal people. Concept of sociopathy, I think, is more of a modern term, and with very few exceptions, wasn't really talked about in the ancient world, probably because in many ways it didn't exist. That's strictly a modern mass society conception. The evil aren't human in the proper sense, because it is a subversion of everything that exists and therefore everything that is good. It's a privation. If evil is a privation or a misuse of something, then the evil person is really a misuse of humanity. It's a misuse of what makes human beings human, and that is reason and freedom, two sides of the same coin. Now, the concept of the efficient cause. If someone were to say that everything comes under divine providence in a very strong way, meaning that everything, even the tiniest little thing, occurs directly from God's will without any freedom whatsoever, that means God is the efficient cause of every little thing. And of course, that would mean that there is no will, there is no culpability, and really reason has no purpose. If everything is determined, then reason doesn't even make sense. Everything would be internal, everything would be genetic. But all what we consider to be pain, and it's not even to say that it isn't real pain, but we only see it as pain because it's very vivid. The minute it happens to us, we are miserable. Sometimes pain overrides our rational faculty. Others, however, can say, I know this is awful now, but if you get through this, nothing's ever to be able to touch you again. You will find strength and virtue that you never knew you had. So then, when seen over the course of an entire life, pain is a very good thing. Most of what we do comes from our own privations. We don't have something that we want. We have to work for it. We have to be disciplined because of it. Therefore, any absence, any desire, legitimate or otherwise, requires, is painful. The problem is that when we get it, it doesn't really alleviate the pain only for a short time. Still, though, pain is what, in a broad sense, is what drives us to do anything. Pain contains, according to Boethius, a hidden purpose. Yes, things occur providentially, but as we said before, that has nothing to do with our willing it. Virtue is something that has to be voluntary. If you accidentally do something wonderful, no one gives you credit for it, because you didn't mean it. You didn't do any work for it. It was a complete accident. But it becomes more powerful if you, in fact, take on pain and discomfort for the sake of doing something good. And virtue is the only thing, you know, using reason this way, the only thing that could produce something like that, something that no other animal can do. And we're not talking about natural things, we're talking about, you know, social things, cultural things. Yes, an animal will die for its babies, but that is not voluntary. It may be deliberate, but it is not voluntary. Freedom is lost. Freedom, in fact, doesn't make any sense when put to a bad use. So you say, I'm willing something. I want something. I'm doing something right now. And we know this with certainty because we're viewing it. We're doing it. It doesn't follow, as I said before, that it is therefore determined. God knows everything, of course. But this isn't it doesn't possess the meaning that we give it. As I said earlier, knowledge and will are two different things. Or knowledge and control are two different things. God knows, we'll put it this way, God knows future events because they happen, because he is in an eternal present. There is no past, present, and future. God knows future events because they happen, not that they happen because God foreknows it. Again, two very different things. Things happen in his eternal now. He knows that. But it's not the same thing as to say that things happen because he foreknows it. Now, I mentioned earlier, and this is all closely connected here, the conception of universals, which is that which nominalists deny. And this battle was raging at the time. You see it with writers a bit later, like Roscullen, like Abelard, and then reaching its zenith with Occam, and then the modern world being based on the same conception, whether it be Machiavelli or Thomas Hobbes. It's a single line denying that universals exist. Universal truths exist. Now, this is how Boethius summarizes, at least at his time, the nominalist argument. Everything that exists, every object that we could point to, is unified in and of itself. It's one thing. For all practical and utilitarian purposes, everything that we could point to and talk about is one in number, exactly how he puts it. Now, a universal, we could put it like this. Nothing that covers, no object that covers more than one thing could be one. But that's what a universal is. There is a universal conception of love, which is very real in and of itself, and we tap into that every time we perceive or understand a loving act. And of course, there's many of them. So you have one thing, that is the idea of love, to be found within millions and millions of acts of love, things that are loving. So, in this argument, a universal can't exist because it can't be one. The premise, of course, that everything that exists is unified, is one and number. They exist only in thought, which is the nominalist argument. Yes, of course, we could talk about love. There's no other way to communicate with people unless we use universals. To them, it doesn't imply that there is this actual spiritual presence of love that is to be found in every act of love, in one form or another. Therefore, you know, if a universal is more than one, or at least manifests in more than one thing, it can't be real. Now, that was the argument of the day, where universals can. And Chris, you know, Boethius is also a very early Western theologian, and he has to worry about this because of things like human nature, divine nature. These are universals. You can't be a Christian and be an anomalous at the same time. They try to escape it, as Occam did, by saying, yes, universals exist, but we have no access to them. They exist only in God, which is really an arbitrary statement because I'm not sure how he knows that. And he comes down to the fact that the only reason we do what we do is because God commands it, not because we could find its rationality in and of itself. But his own answer to that, in good scholastic fashion, he says, thoughts that we have in the world are of two kinds. The only one that's useful is one that actually corresponds to something that's real. Thoughts that correspond with actual things in one form or another. And then everything else, thoughts that concern fantasies, things that don't exist, lies, misconceptions, evil. Now, universals are empty because, of course, in this scheme, and he's talking about his opponents, of course, that these are a universal as a functional thing, a real thing, is an empty thought. Now, because non-corresponding thoughts are not real, universals aren't real, therefore any thought about them can't be significant either. In fact, it's an empty category. But then he runs into a problem. This isn't the case when the things we're talking about are abstractions. So when you are observing a carpenter at work, we can detect lines and points. We can abstract from what we're looking at and see things like number, point, line, the laws of geometry. Laws of geometry aren't present in the table. They may be manifest in the table, but no one denies that the laws of geometry are real and that they exist, and that they exist separate from this table as a spiritual entity. No one's actually ever seen a point before. It's a conception that you need to make sense out of anything you perceive. No one's ever seen a line before. We've only seen manifestations of a line. That's the exception to the rule here. Now, it's not, you know, St. Augustine defined the spiritual realm, in the realm of logos, by talking about things like number. He uses a very similar argument, and Augustine was just before Boethius. Boethius was well aware of it. Of course, Augustine was vehemently opposed to nominalism and was a Platonist, at least to some extent, that numbers and what we do with them, you know, two and two, it's not really two of anything, but it's just a conception of it, that isn't empty and false just because it's not necessarily instantiated in something. We may learn about it that way, but that's not what it is ontologically. So Augustine's argument, to be very simple here, Augustine's argument is that numbers are eternal spiritual entities. Because even when we consider them separate from whatever they may manifest, whatever, you know, carpentry or you know, geometry or anything else, you know, things that we can see in front of us, when they're abstracted and seen as abstract things, they're still very real. It's not an accident that Plato himself was a mathematician. Mathematical objects are real whether or not we ever see them instantiated in anything. No one has seen a perfect line before. And yet we have a conception of it, and the laws of geometry have a connection to it. Therefore, it's real. We may never see one. I'm not even sure if such a thing is possible. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. That's his argument in favor of universals. It's still true. Now, the other way to approach it is, and I think I've mentioned it in my book on nominalism, the nominalist has to say, when you get a person, a human being, and you strip away their accidents. Now, an accident is something that's not necessary to the person. So I could be a human being, and I'm Greek, and I'm well-educated. Well, I could be a human being without being either Greek or well-educated. Those are accidents. Those are qualities. The essence is human as a reasoning, free being. So if I strip away all the accidents, what am I left with? You're left with the essence. Now, the nominalist, you know, someone like John Locke, has to come to the conclusion that there is nothing left. You take away our qualities, it doesn't exist. And of course, the question is, what do these qualities adhere to? You could be a human being and Greek. Well, the human being is just something that looks like a human being. You take all those qualities away, you take Greek away, and you have nothing. You don't even have reason. And this is where the nominalists really get into a lot of trouble. Boethius also worries about, and this is, you know, it will never end, the worry about how to ascribe attributes to God. You know, this is an era, the Arian period, all kinds of heresies, different in the West and the East. Arianism, you know, is going to take over everything for a short time. And this is ultimately where, you know, this is where the medieval logic comes from. This is where medieval metaphysics come from. And this is why I wrote the book, not just on, you know, the philosophical issue of universals, which, you know, is billions of topics or books, but specifically in the theological context, because that's where this battle really comes from. Nominalism, realism occurred at its zenith in the Middle Ages. And this is because, you know, of course it occurred in the ancient world too, but it didn't have the force that it did in an era where this really mattered. Because if you can't make any sense of what the two natures of Christ are, then you can't be a Christian. Then your faith makes no sense whatsoever. This is why you can't be a nominalist and a Christian at the same time. Or I guess you could make an exception for Christ, but because if there's no human nature, I'm not sure what it is that's being saved. What did God take on himself in Logos as a second person of the Trinity when he was incarnated? What is it? That's the ferocity of the battle. This wasn't just academic. This has to do with the whole foundation of Western Europe. And so we say something like, God has an attribute. God is great. Okay? God is great, but that's a very odd thing because we're using human language. We talked about the limitations of being human. We as human beings exist as more than just an abstract rational machine or a free, reasonable organism. We have to have qualities. This is one of the reasons the liturgy exists, why bread and wine are used in the liturgy. We need this physical side because we are, in fact, two things, both spirit and matter. But when you apply it to God, it doesn't make any sense. And can you even say God is great? God is greatness, which is not the same thing as saying God is great. A human being could be great, but in no way could a human being be greatness as such. So Boethius says, in the created order, in our world, someone has an attribute. Someone is great. Someone is extraordinary in some way. And there's two ways that could be the case. The first is by participation. which is a classic Platonic realistic idea, where you, in the term hypostasis, you stand under something. The form of whatever it is. Someone is great, therefore they are within the form of greatness, but not greatness itself. But then you can have an attribute, essentially, and that, in our case, would be reason. So the phrase Plato is an animal, or Plato is a mammal, or Plato has a faculty of reason. Those exist in essence, because that's what a human being is. That Plato is Greek, that is by participation. Now, Augustine says nothing is predicated of God by participation, because that would imply there's something greater than God, something that he is, in fact, standing under. What a human being says, someone's great, or even they're great, there's a difference between having it and being it. God isn't really great, but he is greatness itself. Now, when you're great by accident or by participation, it's possible that you're not. It's possible that you're wrong, you're thinking of the wrong person, whatever it is. You say God is greatness, or God possesses greatness by virtue of being greatness. It can't be otherwise. When you are greatness, it's impossible. There's no, it's inconceivable almost. And that actually is a distinction, another distinction that's very important. God doesn't have accidental qualities. This is something that exists in the East and in the West. Of course, I first came across it in Thomas Aquinas. It is impossible for God to be anything but great. God wouldn't make any sense if he wasn't greatness itself. But it's the same way that created things are not greatness, but created things are rational. And that doesn't exist by participation. That exists by essence. The confusion, especially the confusion of the day, is that sounds an awful lot like what God is. God isn't, rational. God is reason, with the capital R, but what logos comes down to. The difference is between impossible and inconceivable, two different things. And we say the word impossible only relative to the structure of the world. The way things are structured, it's impossible for man, I mean this abstractly, to be anything but rational, even if stuff's in potential. That's what makes a man a man, makes a human being a human being. Reason, freedom, two sides of the same coin, because one doesn't make any sense without the other. If you have reason, you have freedom. If you have reason without freedom, it doesn't even make sense. There'd be nothing to deliberate on. But inconceivable is that God is something other than great by possession, that God is in fact greatness. He is among other things, the utmost of greatness. He doesn't actually possess it. He is it. Now he asks the question then, we talk about the Trinity as being one God, then how can the Father and Son exist? How can someone be both Father and Son? There he has to use Aristotle's 10 categories. And the first three, of course, are substance, quantity, and quality. Those are the only three that actually refer to any object in and of itself. Everything else has to do with their external situation. Father and Son are elements of relation, having nothing to do with God being God. It is a relationship external to them. And then, of course, this relationship that we ascribe using the father-son metaphor. We know what is father and son because we're highly limited. We don't have the capacity to understand what essentially the inconceivable world, the inconceivable relationships that God has. The problem of the Trinity is relatively easy. I never had a problem with it. I know so many people do. But the simple answer is that everything we talk about exists in this, either in our world as physical things or as reasonable, as things coming from reason, but we still need physical things to reason about, situations to reason about. That's how we conceive of things. Therefore, when we're talking about relations of the persons of the Trinity, well, we have no direct apprehension of this. So our language doesn't reach that high. And this comes back to the earlier question. While God exists outside of time, there's never going to be a time where we can. Yes, we'll have a glorified physical nature, but I don't care what the nature is. It's still going to be in one form or another in time. This is because we seek the good, which is our rational nature without without the accidents, or being perfectly conformed with the accidents. And that's who we are by nature. But it seems that we say the same things of God, that God is reason by nature. So there has to be a difference between those two things. And the difference is one of inconceivability versus impossibility. A human cannot be a human. They can act inhuman, but they're always going to be human, no matter how much they deny it. The law of contradiction can't be denied, because in order to deny it, you have to use the very law of contradiction to try to deny it. You can't deny reason, because in the process of denying reason, you have to use it. So these are impossible. The way that the world has been structured, this is what being a human being comes down to. Qualities are important, but only as they manifest the essence. God is greatness. The essence of a human being is reason. These are two very different things. And this is ultimately why Boethius had, it is so easy for us to say, but this is why Boethius didn't have anything really to be sad about. Because the essence of what it is to be a human being, and therefore what it is to be happy, are reason and freedom, two sides of the same coin, are not taken away from him. Virtue has nothing to do, and freedom has nothing to do, with your freedom of movement. I'm not sure how strict his confinement was. Again, they didn't have normal prisons back then. They didn't have orange jumpsuits or anything. He was able to write and function. But what makes a human being a human being cannot be taken away from him. Well, if you define happiness as reaching, as far as humanly possible, activating and fully realizing this essence as rational, free, and therefore moral being, then what difference does it make where you were or what condition you're in? Anything else, being able to wander around money and prestige and everything else, that is only an accident. That's just a quality. You could have money and be virtuous or not be. That has nothing to do with being human. It might be nice, but you can never attach yourself to it. You can't build a personality around those kind of images, those kind of fantasies. The fantasies of what you thought, I'm going to be happy when I get money, that's a thought that it doesn't correspond with anything. It's an empty category. The only thing, and this is Stoic as much as it is Boethian, and of course Boethius was a Roman, he understands Stoicism. Reaching the essence of who you are. See, God already is. He just is. Human beings have to fight for it. Human beings have to manifest reason, freedom, and therefore morality. There's only an absolute minimum of that you need. And if that's the nature of happiness, then all the external, the ornamental things, at most, are just that, ornamental. But in many cases, they actually tear you down because you start associating your very personality with these things. Boethius became famous for, among many other things, but mostly because he explained what human happiness was and that he could be happy while in prison. Whether or not he was strong enough to actually, you know, believe that day to day, we'll never know. That doesn't mean that what he says is false. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.